Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with author Susan Orlean about the unusual life of Rin Tin Tin.
This was a dog who was remarkably athletic, but he also had a very expressive face.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Stephen Heller describes his latest visuals column.
These are called isotypes. It's a pictorial language that is known for those signs that you see in public places.
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. Susan Orlean is one of America's most admired and successful nonfiction writers, the author of a number of bestsellers, including a new one. It's called Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend. It's reviewed on our cover by my colleague Jennifer Schuessler, who says that Orlean has written a sweeping, expertly told tale. And I want to add this because it's pretty funny. She says, by the end, the story may persuade even the most hardened skeptic that Rin Tin Tin belongs on Mount Rushmore with George Washington and Teddy Roosevelt, or at least somewhere nearby with John Wayne and Seabiscuit. I'm delighted that Susan is joining us today from Ann Arbor, Michigan, a town I know well, to talk about her book. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you. Great to be here.
All right. Rin Tin Tin, famous dog. Tell us a little bit about his story or the many stories and the many Rin Tin Tins.
Rin Tin Tin, to my astonishment, and really the fact about him that drew me into the story initially, is not only a 1950s television character, which is what I knew him to be, but in fact a real dog who was found as a puppy on a battlefield in World War I in a bombed-out dog kennel. He was the puppy of a German war dog, which is interesting because he became this American icon, but in fact he was one of the Kaiser's dog's puppies. He was found in this wreckage by an American GI named Lee Duncan, who was a very vulnerable, lonely guy who found companionship really most totally with animals. He found the puppies, he brought them back to California where he lived. He spent every spare minute training and hanging out with the puppy, and then decided to try to get him into movies. Became convinced that Rin Tin Tin would be the greatest star the world had ever known.
And now, Susan, this was during the silent era, is that right?
That's right. This was in the 20s, where Hollywood was really just getting started. Lee lived really over the hill from Hollywood, and it was still an industry where it took guts to knock on doors, but you could actually do this knock on a door and say, I have a really well-trained dog. You should put him in a movie.
And what were the first movies that Rin Tin Tin was in?
He had a small part as a wolf in The Man from Hell's River. That was his breakthrough role, is to fill in when a wolf was not doing a good job being a wolf. The next thing that happened is Warner Brothers actually took Lee Duncan up on his offer and produced his screenplay, which he had written with it in mind that Rin Tin Tin would star in the film. And he was an instant hit. He was a sensation. The film became an enormous success that just grew and grew and grew.
And what was so remarkable about him? Did he actually have, it sounds crazy to ask, but here we are, a gift for performance and acting that was captured on screen?
Absolutely. He had a couple of things. First of all, he was a tremendous athlete. He had first gotten filmed clearing a fence of nearly 12 feet in a dog show. So this was a dog who was remarkably athletic. But he also had a very expressive face. We've got to assume he was a great actor because at the same time that he was making movies, 80 other German Shepherds were starring in films. It's hard for us to believe, but German Shepherds were the rage, and dogs in silent films were at no disadvantage. They could be a lead in a film because they didn't have speech, nor did anyone else. He had something extremely expressive in his face that conveyed not just the kind of excitement of a dog, but something a little tragic. And the New York Times actually reviewed his film, saying he had remarkably expressive eyes and ears.
And he almost won the Academy Award?
Well,
in fact, he did kind of win it.
He did. He got the most votes for Best Actor. And the Academy, which was in its first year of existence, had some reservations, thinking it might not give them the stature that they were looking for if they gave Rin Tin Tin the Best Actor awards. They magically recounted the votes and gave the Best Actor to Emile Jannings instead.
So this was like the Florida election of its day, Florida recount.
Exactly. There were hanging chads that were counted. And the tragedy is, when you think about it, Rin Tin Tin has been remembered far longer than Emile Jannings, sad to say. But he kept on and on and on.
Which raises another question. Short as human lives are, dogs' lives are even shorter. So the Rin Tin Tin franchise continued for a long time, so there had to be other Rin Tin Tins.
The first Rin Tin Tin died in 1932, and his death was announced in a national radio bulletin that broke into broadcasting. The next day, there was an hour-long tribute on radio all over the country. His obituary was in every major paper. His presence in popular culture was that significant. It was a huge event when he died. Immediately, Lee Duncan offered up Rin Tin Tin Jr., one of Rinty's puppies, to carry on the tradition. And in fact, he did fill in for the films that had already been slated for Rin Tin Tin to do. He was not the actor his father was, but he held on enough that it helped segue from that first Rin Tin Tin to the third Rin Tin Tin, who ended up being a much more prominent and beloved heir to the tradition.
Is he the one who was on television, or did that come later still?
No, that was later. Rin Tin Tin III was in some films, but then he became, at the outbreak of World War II, the U.S. Army's spokesman. At the time, the U.S. Army was trying to procure 300,000 dogs to use in the war. They had no place to get them except from citizens. So to encourage people to donate their pets to the Army, Rin Tin Tin became the inspiration. He served at Camp Han in California and made lots and lots of public appearances and public service announcements and appeared in ads, and in fact inspired tens of thousands of Americans to send their pets to the Army.
Susan, something our reviewer, Jennifer Schuessler, points out, and readers will know from your great book, The Orca Thief, is you're fascinated by these unusual byways in American life and culture. And in this book, too, you explore some of the unusual personalities who were part of this growing fixation on dogs, which continues to this day. Who are some of the people you write about, and who did you meet along the way, the trail of reporting this book?
Well, dogs became this great through line in pop culture for me and all the people involved in that world. My favorite sort of cul-de-sac that I traveled was the story of these two women who introduced the idea of dog obedience to America. Now, it seems so funny to think that had to be introduced, but people weren't used to having dogs in their houses until the 40s and 50s, when they moved to the suburbs, and having a dog was very typical, and pet ownership exploded, and people suddenly had these essentially wild animals living in their home. These two women, Blanche Saunders and Helene Walker, who had a kennel and became very interested in the obedience work that was going on in England, decided to travel around the country, taking their poodles with them and doing demonstrations around the country, showing people that it was possible to tell your dog to sit and your dog would obey you. They ended up performing to thousands and thousands of people, including in Yankee Stadium. The other character who became a very central figure in the book to me was Herbert Leonard, the man who produced the Rin Tin Tin television show, who became entirely obsessed, as Lee had been, with the idea that Rin Tin Tin would live forever, that he would exist just migrating from one body to another body and carry on the ideals of loyalty and bravery and heroism forever.
And Susan, when you describe Rin Tin Tin, it makes me wonder whether he in some way epitomized an America that belongs in the past? Was he sort of a product of his moment? Or do we still see these virtues embodied in other ways, in other animals?
I think his rise after World War I makes so much cultural sense. He had a kind of heroism that also had a vulnerability. All of the films showed him really challenged and in many cases sort of suffering as he became heroic, rather than being some kind of superhero who was invulnerable. And when you think about coming out of World War I and people facing horror that they couldn't have even imagined, and maybe feeling their own ability to be brave challenged sorely, I think that kind of hero was so suited to the moment, and he was so embraced. And the fact that he wasn't human, I think animals provide us with a kind of neutral template we can project on, rather than it being another person who you might have feelings about, or you don't like the way they look, or they're a different height than you are, or a different race than you are. You know, that you have all sorts of your own baggage. A dog has a kind of purity that made it easier to admire him and be awed by him. And then came the 60s, and the idea of heroism started turning. And we haven't had an animal hero. We've had a revival of some heroic figures like Superman and Spider-Man, but there is a connection to animals that has changed, though it may be cyclical. We may be ready again to see an animal in that role.
Thanks so much, Susan.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Susan Orlean, whose new book, Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review.
You're ready. You're ready. Bows to thick and thin. From all the tales of the West, we'll remember best Corporal Rusty and Private Rin Tin Tin.
Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So the Booker Prize winner has been announced.
And it is Julian Barnes, who has been nominated or shortlisted three times before, and apparently the fourth time was the charm. He won for The Sense of an Ending, which is a book that was published by Knopf in the U.S.
And whose title derives from a work of criticism by Frank Kermode, I believe. So what do we know about the reaction there? Barnes is a very big guy in England. He's not the young sort of novelist that sometimes prize committees like to favor. So what's the buzz over there?
Well, he was heavily favored to win the prize going into the ceremony and the days leading up to the ceremony. Bookmakers in Britain said that Barnes had the best odds, better than any of the other authors. There are six shortlisted authors every year. But even people who were close to Julian Barnes said that they really didn't think that he was going to win. And the reason they thought that is because he said such derogatory things about the Booker in the past. He said that the Booker is posh bingo. And the Booker judges tend to choose authors who will go out there and say nice things about the Booker after they win it. So even though he was heavily favored, it was a bit of a surprise when it was announced.
Julie, does that mean I have to retract a mildly disparaging comment I once made about the Nobel Prize for Literature?
Perhaps.
Oh, but here's another question. Okay, when you win the National Book Award or the Pulitzer Prize in the United States, there is not only the excitement and the trophy or plaque or whatever, but a lot of books get sold. There's some celebrity that comes with it. Does this happen as well with the Booker in England?
It does, actually. This is one of those prizes that doesn't really attract much attention from Americans until it is announced, but it really does translate into big sales in the United States. In the past few years, authors like Howard Jacobson, who won last year, Hilary Mantel, those authors sold quite a few books in the United States in the 2 to 3 months after the Booker was announced. So the people at Knopf were quite happy when this announcement was made, and they immediately said that in addition to the 23,000 copies that they had already shipped, they would print another 25,000 more in anticipation of the demand. Knopf
demand also, here in the United States.
Yes, demand here. I mean, it'll sell very well in Britain, but it'll also sell really well in the U.S. if previous winners are any indication. In fact, Knopf moved up the publication date from January to last week after the book was shortlisted in September.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Readers of the Book Review are very familiar with our great column Visuals, written by Stephen Heller, the longtime art director of the New York Times Book Review and a celebrated expert and authority on design. He's written well over 100 books, and he's here to talk about the new batch he covers in his column. Welcome, Steve.
Hi, Sam.
All right, so we call your column Vital Signs. What kind of signs are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about the signs that you see on restrooms in airports. These are called isotypes. It's a pictorial language that is known for those signs that you see in public places, schematic men and women and babies and suitcases and taxi cabs. But it was created by Otto Neurath, who was an economist and social scientist in the 20s in Germany and Austria and ultimately England. And he created a language that was based entirely on pictures so that people could have a greater understanding and a more universal understanding of complex information and simple information.
And so it didn't matter what language you spoke. It's a kind of visual language. We go travel all over the world and we see these signs that point us to escalators or entrances and exits. It's that kind of signage?
That's what it has evolved into. What it started out as was a way of explaining the world around us. So it was used for statistics. If there was a certain population demographic, you'd see different symbols and signs that were used to explain that they were women, or they were women from a certain period, or they were women from a certain part of the world. And each icon was drawn to represent or create a stereotype of that individual or thing. And it was used in data visualization, is what we call it now, but it was used in what were information graphics. And it comprised books and magazines and all sorts of ways of communicating raw data, things that the public wouldn't necessarily be interested in a way that the public would be embraced.
Steve, let's move through the other books you covered. There's one called Symbol. What's that about?
Well, Symbol is a very large compendium of hundreds, if not thousands, of design symbols, from logos like the CBS I and the Penguin Books logo, to more generic logos that are used, hearts and finger pointing and other things like that. It is a encyclopedia, so to speak, of these symbols, who designed them and what their purposes were. And it also shows how similar many of the famous logos are. There, you know, I've always said there are only maybe about 10 real original ideas. You could call those the atom ideas. And these are things that get picked up, reused, reinterpreted, and reincorporated into all sorts of other ideas.
And why? Because they work? And are there lots of others that don't work?
Well, a symbol has to work very quickly. It has to grab your eye. It has to be a mnemonic. It has to be something that you understand immediately. So if it's too complicated, it's not going to work. But the reason why there's such repetition is because we live with a very limited language. It is a universal language. So a heart represents a heart. A cross represents a cross. A finger represents a finger. Now, these may have different interpretations in different cultures or additional interpretations, but essentially it's a universal kind of language.
And what about Ex Libris, The Art of Book Plates? What did you find there?
Well, this is a lovely little book that shows a small sampling of book plates. Book plates are those identifiers. If you own a, it's like wearing a T-shirt that says, I've read Catcher in the Rye. Well, a book plate shows that Catcher in the Rye is owned by you. It's a way of taking ownership of a particular book or something else for that matter.
And sometimes the designs are quite elegant and intricate, really works of art. Is that right?
Sometimes the designs are beautiful prints and engravings, and some of them are very personal to the individual whose book plate it is. Some of them are quite erotic, for example. Some of them are very political. Some of them are expressionistic, while some of them are impressionistic. So there is a huge collection of book plates and desire to collect book plates from lots of people because of the vast variety of plate designs.
Well, inevitable question, we're moving away from the printed book to the electronic book. Are book plates now becoming a thing of the past? Are people creating them now and selling them?
People are creating book plates now because they're still books. And it's an art form. Will it become the record album cover of the future? Maybe, probably. But, you know, it's very easy to create an electronic book plate and figure out a way to use it. And people will want to use it. I don't think it'll become a total anachronism.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
Thank you, Sam.
That's Stephen Heller, our visuals columnist, describing the books he reviews in this week's book review. Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
Tell me what's new on the list this week.
Well, not a lot of news on the nonfiction list. Bill O'Reilly is still on top with his book Killing Lincoln, followed by Michael Lewis with Boomerang. There is one new book on the nonfiction list. Steven Pinker, the eminent Harvard psychologist, enters at number 14 with his enormous new book. It is called Better Angels of Our Nature. It is an 800-page history of violence in human culture and human history, and an argument for why, in fact, it has declined. And this is actually Pinker's second bestseller. He had a big hit back in 2002 with The Blank Slate.
What about the fiction list? Any sign of Jeffrey Eugenides' novel, The Marriage Plot?
Yes, he hits the list this week at number 2. He has been kept out of the top spot by Nicholas Sparks, whose latest book is called The Best of Me. But Eugenides is really the book that everybody is talking about this fall. He's sort of the Franzen of 2011.
And Jenny, that's partly because it's been quite some time since his last previous novel, Middlesex, was published, and also because Middlesex was a tremendously successful book.
Yes, that book came out a little more than 8 years ago. There are more than 3 million copies in print. It won the Pulitzer Prize. It was 4 years later chosen by Oprah as one of her selections. I think that probably drove sales a lot more than the Pulitzer Prize. He had two different runs on the paperback list. Interestingly, although the book was quite well reviewed, he never made the hardcover list. It's very tough for literary novels and pretty much always has been. So people were really prime for this book. And, you know, his publisher is really shelling out the bucks to get the word out there. There was actually a big billboard of him in Times Square, quite astoundingly. I'm not sure the last time I noticed a billboard of a literary writer, last time I was walking through there. And this one showed Eugenides in his sort of hipster hippie mode with this paisley shirt and his open vest. And a lot of people were very taken by this vest, which he's been wearing in a lot of publicity photos. And a couple of days ago, suddenly this vest appears on Twitter with its own Twitter feed called Eugenides Vest, sort of filing acerbic comments about everything concerning this novel and its reception.
Let me remind or alert our listeners that Jeffrey Eugenides came to the building, the Times building, not terribly long ago, and he and I did a video interview, which you can find on the website.
Was he wearing a vest?
I don't remember.
Got to go back and check up on that. But anyway, one of the things that this vest has been complaining about is the fact that the marriage plot was left off the list of finalists for the National Book Awards, which was announced recently. And, you know, every year the list of finalists is announced, and there's a lot of grumbling about how there are a lot of obscure novels. The awards tend to reward so-called writers at the expense of, you know, blockbusters, books people might actually want to read, in the words of one critic, you know, and even quite good ones like Eugenides, which has gotten, for the most part, quite good reviews, despite one rather mixed one in our pages.
You know, Jenny, what confuses me about the National Book Award finalists, not every single year, but surprisingly often, is that the writers who are being excluded, presumably on the basis of being crowd pleasers, are actually some of the best writers in the language today. They're major American novelists. Franzen was left off last year for Freedom, this extraordinary book. Now Jeffrey Eugenides. Do we know what the thinking is behind this? Aren't they really writers too?
You could say that. I mean, there are lots of different theories. And of course, the jurors always step up and say, look, we just chose the books that we thought were the best. You know, it's not our job to ratify, you know, popular opinion. And, you know, some people will say there's a lot of horse trading that goes on. Books will get excluded because someone on the jury really doesn't like them. A lot of other people say these are sort of mid-list novelists who like to reward other mid-list novelists. They sort of like the underdog. I mean, nobody exactly knows, but it's interesting. I spent a lot of this week editing an article that will be in next Sunday's book review about the National Book Awards and these sort of long-running debates. And one thing that's interesting is if you go back and look, the NBAs have always been dogged by these kinds of criticisms, even though in the 70s, you look, they gave the prize to, you know, Saul Bellow, to Thomas Pynchon, to Flannery O'Connor. You know, these are not hardly obscure writers. But interestingly, back in 1979, there was sort of a big brouhaha when they gave the fiction award to Tim O'Brien's Going After Cacciato, his first novel, kind of great Vietnam novel, which, you know, these days is regarded as a classic. But back in the day, it was seen as this kind of politically correct upstart that had taken the award away from The World According to Garp, John Irving's novel, which was a favorite that year, and also the Stories of John Cheever, which then went on to win that year's Pulitzer. So, you know, it sort of also makes you realize that the judgment of history and the judgment of today's pundits aren't always exactly the same.
Thanks so much, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.